If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard, the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to the Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are still just a little bit embarrassed about having a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison. I've thought a lot about the tagline of our show, that we're a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I don't think we realize how fundamental to the ethic of our show it would wind up being over time.
Yeah.
When we started the show.
Yeah.
It's a big part of the thing, you know?
It really resonates with people.
It pisses a lot of people off, you know?
The people who aren't embarrassed?
Right, and think that our being embarrassed is somehow a referendum on them not being embarrassed.
Boy, what's it like to not be embarrassed by your interests? Jeez. I would subscribe to that newsletter.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's cool to be, self-affirmative and proud of your own shit. It's just not how I'm wired.
Yeah, no. Yeah, this isn't an indictment on the many good people who are proud nerds of this and any other interest. But yeah, I think that's always going to be my relationship to this material. Love it. I love it deeply, but I'm not putting it out on the street.
Yeah. There's also the kind of person that's super embattled about their nerdery in a way that I can't really get with, you know, if you say something, if you say you don't like something that they like, then they're pissed off at that.
God, I just could not care any less about someone not liking something that I like or
right.
someone
fine.
Liking something
More for
that
me.
I don't like. Yeah.
I guess I said something that about superhero movies on here at some point that somebody yelled at me about on Twitter. I don't remember what it was, and they didn't give me any context when they yelled at me about it. But just I don't know. It's the fucking biggest cultural force in the universe right now. I don't think anything I say is going to do anything to stop it. Take the W, man.
Also, who cares what we say? You're the one caring about it.
Yeah.
I'm an idiot.
Yeah. I admit it in the subtitle of my own podcast. Yeah. But speaking of times we've been embarrassed, I have a bad bit moment that I thought I would share with you, Adam.
All I do is
bits.
No matter what.
You're always doing
bits.
No matter what.
You're always doing
bits.
I was doing bits.
Bad bit moment. Lay it on me.
So, usually these are times we did a bit out in the world in a context where it wasn't really a time or place where bits are being done and they didn't land well
mm-hmm.
or whatever. But you were actually there for this one.
Oh.
And I wrote it down because it was so painful to watch this bit just burn up on the launch pad. That fucking school teacher in the cockpit and nothing we could do to save her. I'm a little unclear on the timeline of when this episode comes out, but I think we'll still be in the midst of our friendly fire
yeah.
tour of duty, our little mini tour of friendly fire that we're doing this spring. And the tour like came together super last minute. Like we announced it way later than we would normally announce. It was like literally like a call where we got on the phone with our booking agent, and what I had understood in talking to you and John was that we were going to cancel the tour in this phone call. And what we wound up doing was booking the tour and like going like, okay, I guess we have to announce it like tomorrow. Oh, fuck.
The way you want to do something that can cost you a lot of money.
Right. Yeah, so so it was, you know, it has been a bit of a hectic spring for us as a result. And I wrote this down during the call because there was a lot surprising me during the call, but this maybe surprised me the most, that I did a little bit and it did not work. The bit was we were all kind of taking each other's temperatures. Are we doing this tour or not? And I said, sure.
I want to get on the road again. The life I love is making podcasts with my friends, and I just want to get out on the road again.
And you laugh now, but there were, like, it was like Rob Schulte edited in a fucking crickets drop on that fucking call. Because John, our booking agent Josh, and you just gave me a clean 5 seconds of silence. Like, we wouldn't have even had to, like, cut clips to edit in the cricket sound effects, because there was silence there. And it's like, Willie Nelson? No? Nothing?
And that's a musical reference that should hit all of us.
I thought that, like, I am the least likely to get that reference of the four people that were on that call, by far.
Like, that was the most shocking element of it. It's like, I thought that there's no way that could have been Ben. That had to be our booking agent, right?
And then I was in this weird position where I was like, did nobody get that? Like, do they not know? Am I the only person that knows that song?
Sometimes in a conference type call, you know, your audio will drop and you may be moved to ask if everyone's still there. That is not a question you want to ask after doing a bit.
No.
Because that just seems like super needy. That's bit needy.
Yeah. So the confusion I had in that moment was like, A, did nobody know the song and therefore not get it? Or B, was it just so profoundly unfunny? Like, you would think that my close friends and colleagues would give me at least a courtesy laugh on that one.
You're not wrong. I will tell you that, I mean, I remember the moment now that you've reminded me of it. I want to believe that it was, we had spreadsheets open and calendars open, and I feel like my attention was divided between the call and like the logistics of what we were talking about.
Yeah.
And by the time, like, retroactively my mind heard what you said several seconds later, like the time for natural laughter was over, and the one sound that I hate more than any in the world is performative laughter.
Right.
And I wasn't going to do that to you or for you. and maybe that was the conflict in my mind at that point.
Is it possible that everybody had that problem though? Everybody was looking at a spreadsheet when I said that?
I mean, I can tell you one thing that I would bet all of my possessions on and my own life on is that John did not have a spreadsheet open at that moment. John was in a car or a bathtub or
pooping.
Any number of things. But yeah, he did not have a screen, that's for sure.
I have a question, because I really like going on tour, and I feel like we always have a lot of fun going on tour.
Uh-huh.
But I remember at some point, either during that call or right before it or something, you said something like, oh, you know, Ben always, like, is the one that's really, like, wanting to go on tour. Is that true? Do you, like, not like going on tour that much?
That's a good question. I think I'm one of those people that feel better about it once it's over than in the run-up and during.
Wow.
Like, and that's not to say that it's never not a great time or something. I just, like, the logistics of those things are like a self-imposed stress. Like, you make fun of me a lot for how organized I am about things, but it's just like the only way that my mind can function is to like spreadsheet shit out. And like, that's the way I understand how things work.
Yeah.
And like my need to do things like that to every little thing is even more pronounced when it comes to like four people and hotel and flight information and who to contact at venues. Like, it's just an order of magnitude problem.
If we got to a point in our career where we had like a tour manager who just told us, you know, like, tomorrow you have to be in the lobby at this time, and we didn't have to have our fingers on any of that stuff, would that make it more fun for you?
You know what this is related to? It's like, I think John and I were having this conversation a couple of days ago. Like, we have done our best to construct a professional life that on the surface should be stress-free, but in reality is incredibly stressful because of the self-imposed schedule concerns that we have on any given day or at any given week.
Yeah.
And it's like what having a podcast producer does to alleviate that stress for some shows. Like, the analog to that is the tour manager possibility that would alleviate a lot of that stress. Like, we've said before, like, the most stressful moments in my life are the hour before Doors where we're still teching a show.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's like a long-winded way to say that if you were able to remove everything besides the performance from the tour,
yeah,
that was stressful to me, I would 100 times out of 100 choose to go out on tour. But like, it's all the other, it's all of the eels attached to things that, like, there are so many of those other concerns in opposition to the one fun thing that happens on tour that like the math is bad.
Yeah, to me, the time in between walking out on stage and like shaking the last hand and taking the last picture in line in the line at the mm-hmm. merch table afterwards is like as much fun as I have most years.
Yeah, agreed.
Like, it's so fucking great.
No question. Yeah.
And it feels worth it to me to do all the like logistical stuff, but it is a fucking mountain of logistical stuff. And
I will say that like it's never so much that I feel like we shouldn't do it. You shouldn't feel like I'm being dragged out there to do that stuff. If I didn't want to do it, I wouldn't do it.
Okay.
I'm stubborn enough to not participate in a thing that I don't want to do.
Yeah, I would not expect you to agree to something that you weren't into 100% for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
that is to say that on future tours, I hope we don't agree to a thing that we then do several weeks later. I like a little more pre-production time.
Yeah, I think that
this
Friendly Fire tour has been of particular stress just because the amount of time we had to put it together was a quarter as much as we usually get.
Yeah, like getting ticket counts for shows 6 months in advance is a pretty chill message to receive instead of the one for 6 days from now where you're like, giddy up. Like, this could be the situation, you know? Mm-hmm.
Well, all that being said, it is really fun to tour. And when we tested our ability to tour back in the day with our Two Captains, One Nexus tour, we had no right to think that we would have the capability of putting on a fun show, you know? Neither of us were performers prior to that.
I'm really glad that we went out on that first tour and did it all ourselves. Like, we really were introduced to what you have to do a show.
Yeah.
In that first four-show run. And it made me appreciate all of the benefits that a booking agent grants, and how much easier it is to tour when you don't have to. Like, there's a lot of shit behind the scenes that goes along with touring that that can be both easy and hard depending on your relationships to certain people. So
right,
we're in a better place now for sure.
Yeah, we sure are. We're very lucky to have met the people we've met, and I think we're lucky to have found a way to put on a show that is fun for people to come see, because I really like doing it.
I think the main best thing about what we do is like we have the control of what we're doing. And that is related to the episode we're going to watch today, Ben.
Wow. That is a fucking professional level pivot.
Right?
Shit.
We control the means of production, Ben, for Uxbridge Shimoda LLC. Let's see how it works at Quark's Bar as we discuss Deep Space Nine, Season 4, Episode 15, Bar Association.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
LeVar Burton episode.
Bullshit, man. It's just bullshit.
Yeah.
So this episode starts with the little D coming home with a broom on the mast. They've been out in the Gamma Quadrant. They've made a clean sweep. No Jem'Hadar.
Worf briefly rode the conning tower in their escape from the G-Quad.
Yeah. There's a little interaction between him and Dax that kind of like, it's like all super pro and then a little dab of flirtation peppered in.
Mr. Worf, you're in love.
Yeah.
With the Defiant.
There's like a fun double talk happening between Dax and Worf. But for someone eavesdropping, what they're hearing is Worf is like a guy with a car that needs tinkering all the time. Worf has fallen for his ship.
Yeah. And I like that Dax is like, has like an extra dimension of this conversation that she understands that he clearly doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, like she understands that they're flirting and he is flirting, but he does not understand that they're flirting.
They clearly have chemistry together, but I still don't know why she likes him. Worf has had a bad season, I think, in season 4 as a character.
Yeah.
Like, he's not been particularly good professionally. He's definitely not good personally with his family affairs.
He just killed his brother.
Yeah, and so, like, besides their interest in Mechleth versus Batleth training, I'm at a loss for really what it is that that attracts them as people.
Sometimes that's something that you can't quite put your finger on, man.
Love
finds a way.
It's pretty hard for me to imagine what my wife likes about me.
Yeah.
But I don't want to question it too much.
Yeah, that's right. You don't want to crush that rabbit.
Worf just wants to have sex with the Defiant.
Put it right in the warp core. I feel like we're going to get, over the course of the series, a lot of establishing shots in Quark's of O'Brien and Bashir wearing X kind of weird garb on their way to the holosuites, and it's kind of a weird reverse walk of shame, right? You've got to go through Quark's to go to the holosuites.
Yeah.
And they seem to be the only ones that ever, like, do that kind of walk.
Yeah, and they're in their Game of Thrones cosplay.
You know there's a version of this walk where a bedraggled Dr. Bashir emerges from a holosuite, like with his hair messed up and he's super sweaty and gross. Like, you never see that version.
Nobody's ever like in their quarters putting on their gimp outfit and they go like computer site-to-site transfer to holosuite 2.
Yeah, that would be preferred, wouldn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
They're going to have the holographic dominatrix flog them for an hour. They don't want everybody to see what they're into.
You only see them going in and not coming out.
Yeah. I feel like over this series, we are also going to find the directors and showrunners of this program find ways for Lita to bend over and pick something up off the floor in an establishing shot.
Look, I'm going to believe that this is not LeVar Burton direction here. I think this is just a sensibility that the show has, W/R/T, Lita.
Right.
No one really catches either O'Brien or Bashir in their weird warrior garb or Lita's bendover in Quark's because Quark's is kind of deserted.
Yeah, it is. It's like Bajoran Lent, basically, right?
Yeah.
Or Bajoran Ramadan. They've all sworn off the pleasures of the flesh, and that includes holosuites and gambling and drinking. And yeah, like there's the Dabo girl with the prodigious underboob has nobody to spin the wheel for.
It's a real shame, too.
And despite this, Rom is being forced to work through an earache.
Oh.
And given the size of those ears, you can imagine what an earache is like.
It hurts.
It introduces the question of whether or not Quark is more of an uncaring boss or an uncaring brother.
Yeah.
Because he displays absolutely no mercy.
I really like the little chemistry experiment that happens here. This is something that happens fairly seldom, but often enough that I think it's a bit of a Star Trek trope, the like chemistry experiment at the bar where
like one solution is introduced to another and it like foams up or changes color in a cool way. And then Rom dumps this concoction into his ear. You're kind of like, the misdirection is that he's mixing a cocktail for Morn, but in fact he's making something corrosive to pour into his ear to deal with whatever is ailing him.
I gotta say, like, because it's Rom, I expected this liquid to come out of his other ear after going in the first.
Boy, that would have been amazing.
Wouldn't that have been a fun sight gag?
Oh my God. You're just like, wait, so what is going on with the Ferengi's ears?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it would tell you so much about their physiology.
Yeah. Leeta comes over expressing concern for what Rom is going through, and Quark kind of jumps down her throat.
I pay you to spin the dabble wheel, so get spinning.
And we actually cut to Rom's POV, a rare POV shot for Star Trek, and it's like blurring in and out.
It's just a vignette of Leeta's boobs.
Last episode, we talked about how I got like incredibly sick on your birthday getaway in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
This was as sick as I've ever felt.
You were boob vignette sick?
Well, there were 2 hours where I was in bed in my room, and I was panting because breathing through my nose was slightly more uncomfortable than breathing through my mouth.
Whoa.
And in the wake of that, like, I was sick all day. I was very uncomfortable all day. But there was a point at the middle of the day where I was like, I was like, I've been sick in bed for like 8 hours. Maybe I should jack off.
You know what always helps Papa feel better?
Like, maybe it'll make me sleepy and I'll be able to sleep through some of this.
Like, would that have been the worst walk-in that your wife could ever do? Concerned wife for her sick husband? Oh yeah. My God.
What are you? You fucking piece of shit. You're not sick.
So was this all about trying to find some time to do that? All of your friends are upstairs. You've never been too sick to jack it, Ben.
Never.
That's how we knew it was serious.
Yeah.
Bashir can change Kern's appearance, Kern's memory, and his genetic code. But when it comes to Rom's ear infection, it is a big, big challenge. And Bashir kind of gets into it with Rom a little bit on why he might have let this go on for so long, because ear maladies for Ferengis can get pretty serious.
This is a 3-week-old ear infection.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you've got like a staph infection in your ear, that could be lethal.
That's a lot of spilled product going into the ear canal over that amount of time, right?
Yeah.
Quark is going to notice that that's not just alcohol evaporation.
That's more than the normal shrink that would be anticipated by a bar.
Rom mentions as an excuse that, you know, there are no sick days or vacations or paid overtime at Quark's. Like, he had to work through his illness.
Yeah, he didn't have free time to come into the infirmary, and Bashir kind of tosses off fairly casually, like, oh, you should form a union.
Yeah, Bashir also, like, tending to a novelty thermos collection as he dispenses this advice.
I know. Yeah, it almost looked like the like, sports drink section of a 7-Eleven over there.
Yeah. What was that about?
I don't know. That is like such different prop design than we normally see on this show.
Yeah.
But Rom is back together, and speaking of jacking it, he's back in Quark's bar, and Leeta's like, what happened to your ear? And he's like, oh, I've been umoxing myself too much.
Is that the first time there's ever been a reference to masturbation on Star Trek?
I actually looked this up at him because it caught my attention. It's the first reference to masturbation in the history of television.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
The thing is, like, you've got to pee after umox or else you're going to get an ear infection.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how it works for a Ferengi.
And it's your partner might just slip off and go to sleep, but you got to get up and pee, and it seems unfair, you know?
Yeah.
Golden Carton.
The Cut.
Golden Carton.
So,
So there's an all-hands meeting at Quark's, and Quark announces that he is cutting everyone's salary by a third, because cutting salary is better than doing a layoff.
Well, they've got this great deal in capitalism where the workers suffer when the company is not doing that well, but there's no upside for them when the company is doing great.
Yeah, there is no profit-sharing situation at Quark Co.
They don't issue you stock certificates as you vest in the company.
There was a time in one of my many retail jobs where the company I worked for did do profit-sharing.
Wow.
And if you were an hourly employee and the company had a particularly good year, when it came time for the yearly financials, the profits, some of the profits were shared among employees, but that was a long, long time ago. And the idea of that almost seems quaint right now. Right?
Yeah, it does.
This same company I worked for was like many of the companies where there was a strange relationship with union and non-union employees wherein non-union employees looked askance at union employees, and the company itself was very, very, very discouraging of the union employees and the idea of forming unions, to the degree that the understanding of such a concept was actively suppressed and ridiculed.
There's anti-union propaganda that pervades just the way they are talked about. The image of the union employee as lazy and entitled and taking breaks all the time and stuff is it is a poison in our culture that I totally have drank that Kool-Aid at times in my life, like working on film sets and you're like, oh, the fucking Teamsters are taking their break right now or whatever. And it's because human beings don't need to work 24 hours a day. And I think you don't really realize who's interested is in that you incorporate ideas like that in your assessment of people who have chosen to become members of a union.
Right.
They're relying on you not to ask that question of yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. My very first union interaction came when I was 15 years old, and I was working, my very first job was at a grocery store, and I worked at a union building, and I worked maybe 16 hours a week for minimum wage, and I had to pay $60 a month in union dues, and that was a big portion.
Yeah.
But that's a big percentage of a kid's take-home pay.
Totally.
At that point, and it really I was an unsophisticated idiot, and I still am, but that was a bad introduction to
lemonade. Was a popular drink, and it still is.
That's a bad introduction to the concept, and it took me a while to come around to the idea of all the benefits of such a thing.
Yeah,
historical and otherwise.
But anyways, Quark announces all these wage decreases to everybody, and Rom is the one that comes and sticks up for everybody. He kind of zaps Quark as the meeting breaks up, and is like, "Hey, these people are already living paycheck to paycheck. You can't do this to them."
Yeah,
and you can't do it unilaterally and without warning. And Quark is like, I'm the boss. I can do whatever the fuck I want. If you don't want the job, you don't have to keep it.
Yeah, and Rom levels a thinly veiled threat in that moment.
If you don't rescind the pay cuts, you're gonna regret it.
Mechleth training has continued apace between Worf and Dax.
It's not a to be continued, but it really just picks up a story thread from the previous episode. And that's I think something this show is starting to do more and more. We're just living in a world where a storyline that didn't quite wrap up in the previous episode can find life in the next episode.
Evidently, a warrior does not use the locker room shower in the Hollow Suites because they are... They're headed back home, and they hear a rumble from the air duct, and a Daptarian falls out of the ceiling tiles onto the floor near Worf's quarters.
Do not move.
Yeah.
And he's carrying a bunch of Worf's shit.
Why would you steal a tooth sharpener?
Why would you break into the only Klingon on the station's quarters? Find a different target, I think.
Yeah, find a target of a guy who's not likely to be coming home with a sword in his hand.
Yeah, the worst.
So Worf brings this this crook to Odo's office and you know, has him booked, and kind of lights into Odo, kind of gets up on the old high horse and starts to make the case that Odo is terrible at security.
What I want to know is how such a security breach was allowed to occur in the first place.
This is a conflict that they've already kind of had, like the First Minister Shakar is visiting the station episode, had a lot of this stuff in it, and Odo happens to have an iPad at the ready, like for quick draw, with a bunch of like episode recaps as written by the Netflix Corporation of times Worf fucked security up.
This is great.
On the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Like, I think that you could have found better instances of Worf doing bad at security, because these ones, like the like Ferengis using two warships to take over the Enterprise and a guy tricking them into thinking he was a time traveler and stealing shit, those are not Worf's fault exactly.
Yeah. And this is two episodes in a row where the Worf-Odo conflict is alive and well. And I like it. I'm here for it.
I do like it.
In a secret meeting of employees of Quark Co., Rom has made the case for unionization. He's distributed cards, and he would like them completed and filled out.
Yeah. The meeting is pretty intense because all the Ferengis have a bit of a stutter when they use the U word.
We're going to form a
what?
A union!
You get two fun random Ferengis here in this scene. It makes me want like the Ferengi book of baby names, because Frul and Grimp are like, they feel like names that a computer has come up with, like combining letters into a somewhat pronounceable name. I love it.
I wished we got like one of the other non-Leda aliens perspectives, because there's like three or four Dabo girls and maybe like a cocktail waitress among the assembled group of what will come to be known as the Restaurant and Casino Employees Guild, and they just don't have speaking roles. There's two Ferengis that speak up and Leda, and then the, you know, the yellow underboob lady and everybody else are just extras. And I would have liked to know, like, is there unified support for this idea among the non-Ferengis, and it's the Ferengis that need to be brought around, or what?
Yeah, and that's a good question, because so much of the passion weight falls to Leda, and I think that is mixed results, because Leda's the one basically lighting the burn barrel immediately, and like your eye, for a lot of reasons, catches her in the background because she's Leda, but also she's the most expressive and excitable during these moments.
I do like that she's sort of the few clothes of this situation.
I go ton for ton, Logan Colvin, any man here.
Given what her wardrobe usually looks like. Anybody that gets the Meituan reference in the audience is going to be really delighted by that one.
I sure didn't. I'm sorry.
That's a James Earl Jones part in a movie about like unionizing coal mines in West Virginia.
Wow. All right. I've got some homework. So Frul and Grimp are resistant to the idea, but Rom is super persuasive. This is like what Rom does. When he is supremely motivated about a topic, he is very articulate and persuasive with people around him.
You think about like the qualities of leadership, and Rom is not an emblematic example of any of the things you think of. And yet I feel like this is one of many examples of him kind of riding for what's right and like getting people on his side about it.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking the other day, like, why is Rom not an impression we do on this show?
Yeah.
And I think it would seem cruel in a way that I don't think that any of the impressions we do are intended to be. But there's this other aspect of his character, which is that he's like a righteous dude.
They all adore him.
Yeah, I mean, he is inspiring. He truly is.
And he wins everybody over. Like, the thing that everybody Ferengi in this room is scared of is the FCA, the law enforcement body of Ferengi culture. And they're like, the fact that you've said this basically means we're all fucked forever for the rest of our lives. We will have the FCA hounding us. And he's like, good, like, let's fucking strike a blow that will reverberate even for them.
What are you doing now?
What you need to do is keep this relationship alive. Like the line of communication must be preserved between Ram and Bashir, because for as passionate as Ram is about constructing this union, he knows nothing about unions. And so as a subject matter expert, Bashir needs to be involved. And so Ram pays him a visit mid-cyst-pop because O'Brien is there.
He walks into r/popping.
I am Chief Miles Edward O'Brien, except I've got a disgusting cyst on the back of my neck.
Yeah, and I guess that's what all of the thermoses are for. What Bashir does is like light a match inside one of the thermoses and then put the opening around the cyst.
Fucking spectacular.
It's gross and it's funny. It's one of the lighter moments in the episode here.
I thought it was funny. The thing that hit me in this moment was why aren't there like weird, like, you got like a rash from a Cardassian vole and it's like something really weird looking, or like, I want like a weird space disease, you know, like it, since it's a cyst, it's something that is only talked about and not shown.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do some weird loaf on the back of Chief O'Brien's neck, you know, like let's put something real, real out there.
Give us a space cyst.
Yeah. I want a space cyst.
Sounds threatening. Anything sounds worse when you put space in front of it, right?
Right. So so Ram is there asking, like, what do I do? And O'Brien is like, oh, yeah, like, I come from a long line of blue-collar people, and one of my ancestors in, like, the 1900s was a union guy who shut down the coal mines or whatever, and that's how they extracted a better contract from the management. And that is like the first time Ram has encountered the idea of like a work stoppage as what a collective bargaining organization might use as leverage to get better pay.
O'Brien turns to Bashir and he's like, you know what? We should actually do that as a holosuite program. Let's do the union program. And Bashir's like, cool. That's great. Yeah. Awesome. So what do I wear to that? O'Brien comes from a long line of martyred union guys, and this again, very inspiring.
My ancestor died heroically as a union man. He got shot a whole bunch of times.
You remember when Lieutenant Dan talks about his like the generation after generation of Dans who have died in battle, and like they do the montage of like them all falling dead on the battlefield. It would have been great to see like Colum Meaney made up in different makeup, like falling into a burn barrel, falling into the gears, being shot and thrown off a bridge,
throwing his sabot,
yeah, stabbed with his own picket sign.
Fun. They could have reused the set from San Francisco.
Yeah, that's true.
My dad was involved in a labor action in San Francisco of restaurant workers in like the 70s, I think. And
he was a fucking scab, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't. Somebody from the restaurant poured sugar in the gas tank of his VW bus.
God, has there ever been a more San Francisco story than what you just told?
No.
Pretty far out, man.
Yeah, I come from a long line of people who were an almost self-parodic image of the time and place that they found themselves in. For example, in the mid to late 2000s, when I was a hip-hop music video director living in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, who had a cocktail business on the side.
God. If someone were to give me a character sketch for a television program, I would say it was too on the nose.
A little too on the nose.
Yeah. It feels like it's been forever since we've been to Ops, Ben. Like, has it been 5 episodes since we've been here?
Yeah.
Anyway, we returned to Ops because
they had
O'Brien
to rebuild the set.
Yeah. They only rebuilt the part that O'Brien needs to inspect because he's crawling around under Worf's station.
Yeah.
And this is a moment for O'Brien and Worf to have a moment where they reminisce on the good times on the Enterprise D, on the Big D. Times which, in retrospect, weren't great for both because in a Chief O'Brien at work kind of way, Chief O'Brien does not miss those days. He actually likes all the action that he gets at the station.
Have you any idea how bored I used to get sitting in the transporter room waiting for something to break down?
And that feeling stands in opposition to Worf, whose nostalgia for the D takes the form of predictability. Like,
right.
he knew what to expect over there. He knew where everything was. He knew who everyone was. He knew his quarters weren't going to get broken into.
Well, and I think that it's interesting because Deep Space Nine kind of provides O'Brien with a thing that Worf had on the D, which is, yeah, like, there's always something to do. And O'Brien is describing a life where, like, he basically never had anything to do on the D.
I think there's a strange relationship between O'Brien and his appreciation for being needed, you know, as a thing that works both in work and in family, that Worf clearly does not require in his life from either. He resents being needed by both his family and his workplace.
Yeah.
And it makes them very different.
It's two people trying very hard to connect and being so different that they kind of can't.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting scene in a fairly uninteresting B storyline, I want to say.
They should be best friends, shouldn't they? Because if what Worf misses more than anything is the Big D, there's O'Brien. Like, there's a person that embodies that time for him.
Yeah.
There it sits.
And he rejects it.
Nostalgia is a very toxic impulse. As our buddy John Hodgman is right to say.
Yeah.
So Quark comes back to the bar and finds a tableau of all of his employees assembled there to tell him that they would like to renegotiate their contract. And Quark basically thinks they're doing bits.
Yeah, this is a bad bit moment for Quark.
Yeah.
Page sick leave.
The like you know, he starts like reading through the list and laughing and then gives just like the greatest face of all time when Rahm announces that they are going on strike. like the Quark react to that is perfect.
Leeta does a yeah over Rahm's shoulder that is reflected and amplified by Quark's incredulity here. It's like 11 out of 10.
Is your read on it that Quark in that react is still like, you guys are fucking idiots? Like, oh,
yeah,
fuck you, you're going on strike. How hilarious. Or is
definitely
it like, yeah.
It's because if it's not that, it's a bad take.
No, it's such a sophisticated acting choice. You
yeah,
know?
Agreed.
But it also gives us like one of the funniest faces we've ever gotten on the show.
Yeah, it truly is. It's Tilly card worthy for sure. This is a strike and a picket line that pays customers not to enter the bar.
Is that what they're doing?
Kind of a new spin on striking laborers.
Are they giving out latinum?
Yeah, to not go in the bar.
Wow.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's Fruel or Grimp, but they're like, boy, I sure hope we have enough slips to wait out the strike.
That's such a funny detail. I didn't realize that's what they were doing. I thought they were like handing out like pamphlets or something, but like thinking about it in that way, like the naivete of we'll pay people not to go in is such a true thing that Rahm would actually come up with.
Yeah, it feels like a very natural idea for him to have. They really should have stationed some of the picket line near that side door, because later on when O'Brien and Bashir are like betting on who's going to go in and who's not, like,
yeah,
they need some slips of latinum up there.
Yeah, so there's like a brief interaction. Like Odo comes in and Quark has an army of hollow quarks working in lieu of his employees. And he says, you should like arrest those people, beat up the people that are fighting for their own rights out there. And Odo is like, yeah, like I probably would. I'm more naturally on your side on this than I am on their side.
But I have strict orders from Captain Sisko not to impinge on your employees' freedom of expression.
So we cut to upstairs and And O'Brien and Bashir are like actually like taking bets on who will scab and who won't.
I like this game a lot.
Yeah. Packleds are scabs. We see a packled in there. I thought it was interesting that we didn't get to find out whether Morn was a scab or not.
Wow. Yeah.
Because, like, he's always there.
I think it's because the truth is you know he's there. But, that might be the most obvious answer.
But they don't want you to hate Morn.
Yeah. You gotta love Morn.
But Worf is also a scab, which is a shocker.
So much lately feels like happens off screen. Because once Worf enters, O'Brien's like, oh no, we've got to educate Worf on what's happening here. And so Bashir and O'Brien follow him in.
We've got to human-splain this to Worf.
Yeah, they have a pretty clear difference of opinion when it comes to labor versus management. And then we basically cut to the brig to tell the story, which is a fun bit of comedy through edit.
Yeah, I liked it, and I liked the that it was a red, blue, gold, trio.
That looks
in
good.
In the brig.
Yeah,
there are three guys who have like very different approaches to dignity, but take their dignity seriously, and it is really fun to see that undercut in this scene.
Yeah, I feel like Bashir should be more fucked up for being thrown over a table by Worf.
Yeah.
I don't think it's bad to have had a little more blood there.
I would love to see a neck brace.
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pail.
A fucking pail.
Mr. Bucket, I have to revert back to my living state. I don't use the bucket anymore.
Anyway, Sisko is like, you guys are fucking idiots and you're going to spend the night in jail. I'm not going to do anything to help you right now, even though I could.
Sisko gets the opportunity to be the taciturn teacher figure of this scene, you know? He is loved by these three, but they also need to be punished.
But Sisko does take a meeting with Quark, who thinks that, you know, Sisko is going to be naturally aligned to him, not doing the math on the whole, like, socialist utopia that Sisko comes from. And there is a pretty astounding reveal about the arrangement that Quark has W/R/T rent in this scene, which is that apparently he owes monthly rent on this bar but has not been paying it for years, and he doesn't pay his electrical bill or anything.
He's been earning a profit, a huge profit over the years, and yet pays no taxes. Cool.
Fucking hate it when I find that out about a company.
Pretty shitty. Way to be a good citizen. This is a hell of a revelation, Ben. And this is something that Sisko uses as leverage against Quark.
You're a very generous people.
He's like, if you'd like, I can run your tab. Would you like that? Because if you don't, you should bargain.
Would you like me to, like Mo, send Barney's bar tab to NASA to get tabulated?
You owe me $70 billion.
Yeah, so that really hits Quark where it hurts. And so Quark has to bargain with Rom. And at the 40-minute mark in the episode, we finally get a, like, so much goes unsaid between Quark and Rom in this episode, and one of the things that is not said until this moment is the fact that they are brothers.
And he's basically saying, like, you're hurting me as a brother, and I need you to end this strike, and I will essentially bribe you to do that.
Yeah.
Which is classic union-busting tactic, try and appeal to the avarice of the leader of the action, and does not work. To Rom's credit, he throws the latinum right back in Quark's face.
What's happened to you?
The stress is heightened almost immediately, because by not resolving the situation then and there, we cut right over to the appearance of Brunt inside the darkened bar at Quark's, and he's there to end the dispute by any means necessary. And instead of like holding a billy club and like patting it against his palm, there are some soft focus Nausicaans in the background as his as his heavies.
Brunt has rolled through with hair metal Pinkertons.
Yeah.
And, you know, naturally, Brunt and Quark are aligned here, because Brunt and Quark both have an interest in quelling this uprising. But there's like a meeting of the strikers that we cut to, that, you know, they're starting to feel like they're on their way to victory. Did Grimp look a little bit like Nog to you?
Yeah.
I wondered if they used some of the Nog loaf or something like that.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Because I don't think the actors are related, but he seemed a little bit like Nog.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
When Brunt confronts the assembled strikers, there is not an even split of resistance and not resistance. Fruhl is basically on the ground in fear and shame, because what Brunt is threatening is that should you keep striking, your family funds on Ferenginar will be seized, and you will be you will receive a House of Moog style punishment on Ferenginar.
And Brunt looks down at Fruhl on the ground, offering to suck his dick, and he says, "Fruhl, you idiot, my dick is up here," and he points at his ears.
Yeah, the return of Brunt. He's really throwing his weight around. He's a heavy.
And really twisting them. The idea of retribution against their families is really scary.
Yeah.
And I think maybe one place that this episode fails a little bit is the idea that they decide that that's okay.
Right.
Everybody decides that they're okay with their families being fucked over also.
Yeah.
I mean, I imagine that some would and some wouldn't. Ron makes the case that your bank account back on Ferenginar will be liquidated, but you wouldn't be working as a bartender if you had a really impressive bank account.
Yeah.
But that's not the extent of Brunt's threat.
As the episode comes to a close, we cross cut between this strike and what Worf is going to do about his living situation, because in the aftermath of that bar brawl between Worf, Bashir, and O'Brien, Worf is just unsettled enough about his circumstances there to say, "Fuck it, I'm moving to the Defiant." Which seems like a really out there kind of plan.
"But you'll be living out there all by yourself."
Because to our knowledge, no one lives on the Defiant. It just sits empty like an RV on a parking pad, you know?
I know.
Yeah, I mean, every time you cut to the exterior of the station and the little D isn't on a mission or something, there's a big tarp over it because it's not totally watertight.
Yeah.
It's kind of a depressing place to live, but that's where Worf wants to live.
Yeah.
He likes that Federation architecture.
Morn. Dear sweet. Morn.
In here, buddy.
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
A significant moment in this episode is Rom walking Leeta home after a hard day of striking, and she kisses him goodbye at the end of it, like a friend kiss, and Rom takes this as something that means much, much more. Were he able to blush, he would be a rosy pink at this moment.
Yeah.
And Quark kind of emerges from the corner of the hallway like cigarette-smoking man in the X-Files.
Yeah, there's a lot of shadows to lurk in on the space station.
Yeah.
You could never do a scene like this on the D.
And one of the things that this episode does really well is misdirect who you think is in trouble for striking. Because what's happening right now in this scene is Quark is like, "Look, man, you need to be taking Brunt way more seriously than you are, because I've seen the Noskins he's got.
And I don't want you to get hurt."
Those guys will say, "Play Damjot Human."
Yeah.
Nobody's business.
You're not just in professional danger, you're in mortal danger.
But Ram is not who is in mortal danger. It turns out it's Quark.
Right.
Brunt kind of pitches this at him. He's like, "We can't make a martyr of Ram."
Yeah.
"So we're thinking about beating the shit out of Leeta, but I'm too personally sprung off of Leeta to do that. So the only other person that is really close to Rom is you. So sorry, bud. I know we're on the same side of this thing, but we're going to have to beat the shit out of you."
And when we cut to the infirmary, Quark is fucked up. Bad.
Quark is fucked up the way Bashir maybe should have been.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. They didn't have enough of the bruise color to go around.
He's got the neck brace, the technological head bandage.
"Does it hurt?"
"Of course it hurts."
"Too bad."
I didn't think Rom would have it in him to gloat. Like, I just didn't think that was in keeping with how gentle he is typically as a person. But he has that capacity, and that's what he's there to do.
They come to an agreement here, which is like a lot of political progress. A little bit disappointing.
Yeah.
But a move in the right direction.
Disappointing because the true deal is in private and not in public?
Yeah, and that the union is dissolved.
Do you think the dissolution of the union is also a lie for the public, but actually is still there in private?
It might be a lie for Quark. If Quark believes that the union is dissolved, that's what needs to happen for him to make the deal, right?
You know, the great thing about a union is that you can dissolve a union and reconfigure a union whenever you want to. So it's not like by saying we're going to dissolve it now, that does not limit the possibility of it happening again.
Right. So yeah, the agreement is basically like dissolve the union and we'll do the demands in the new contract, and that will get Brunt off of both of our backs.
And that's pretty much the button on the ep. It's a happy group of employees at Quark's.
And the twist is that Rom takes this labor action across the finish line and then quits,
which is great. He got a new job. He took the correspondence class. He's working nights. He is a customer and not an employee. And Ben, that is a great, great feeling. It's very satisfying to enter a place where you used to work as a customer instead.
He looks great in his little uniform.
I agree. One other final piece of the episode is that Worf does, in fact, move to quarters on the Defiant. Dax gives him a housewarming gift of Klingon operas, and Worf strips his bed in order to sleep directly onto the metal sheet. So that is that.
Yeah.
That's where he's living, and he's fine with it.
Did you like the episode, Adam?
I like it when labor wins, obviously.
Yeah.
Kind of a lot happens in this episode, and I'm really looking forward to Rom's relationship with Quark going forward. We're deep in the territory of Deep Space Nine episodes that I have never seen, so what's coming is going to be a complete surprise, and I'm here for it. What about you?
I really like it, too. It's such a funny episode because it really does feel like a bottle.
Yeah.
And yet, so much changes in a way that is going to, like, change the dynamics between everybody on the show.
Yeah, we are in Quark's Bar all the time as a location on the show, and it's going to feel very different with Rom not there.
The idea of a romance between Leeta and Rom is an established fact. They didn't get distracted and forget about the idea of Dax and Worf being on a romantic collision course.
Yeah.
Despite, like, the shit he's going through, like, that's still totally on the table.
On an empty Defiant, no one can hear me jerk it. Ben, why don't we see what we've got for Priority One messages this week?
I'd love to do that.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Ben, we have a personal Priority One message up top. It is from Whitney. It is to John, and it goes like this. To my number one, happy 10th anniversary. I'm so glad I found you and your DS9 DVD collection. Whitney, I'm just going to, as an aside, I'm going to recommend that you not open up those jewel cases. Just continue to believe. Message continues. Thank you for introducing me to a podcast that we are a little bit embarrassed to listen to. It gave us a good reason to rewatch TNG and DS9 like we did while we were dating. Thank you for all the memories and looking forward to making new ones. Hey, that's great. 10 years for Whitney and John. Congrats.
I love it.
That's, you know, some anniversaries are paper, some are metal. The 10th anniversary is famously the DVD anniversary. And Whitney and John are celebrating.
Hopefully one day it'll be the Blu-ray anniversary.
Also need to mention, this message was meant for April, and because of our great big stack of Priority Ones, this one is going to come out in June. So we did this as soon as we could, John and Whitney. Hope it is no less special for you.
We have another Priority One message here, and it is from Tyler, and it's for Ben and Adam. What is Kevin Uxbridge's favorite British TV series? Downton Abbey. All the best, Tyler.
I bet you love that, too. I bet that's your favorite fucking joke, huh?
I fucking do.
Such a dork.
It starts to get a little uneven in later seasons.
You know, I don't just like Downton Abbey. I prefer all of the masterpiece programs on PBS. And if you're not giving to your local public television station, that's something that you can do even outside of pledge time.
And if you've watched all of the British drama that they've made available to you, check out the Food Flirts. They're two totally charming older ladies from Boston that like to cook different food and experience the differences between cultures and celebrate them.
I know we're in a weird timeline because Food Flirts should not exist as a program. It is insane as a show. I love it.
As far as I know, there's only one season of that. And like if a second season ever appears in my PBS app, my head will fly off my neck.
God. Renew Food Flirts.
It is so fucking great.
It is so joyfully funny.
Yeah.
Like, and the thing is, you are laughing at them, but it's not a cruel kind of laugh at them. Like, they are very self-aware in what they're doing.
Yeah,
I
they're
love
just
it.
Like, we're really silly ladies, and we're going to be silly, silly ladies.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And be in this TV show that somehow happened to us.
All right, well, if you have a message... You know what? If you have a preference about which PBS shows you enjoy and would like to share that with our greater viewership, you can make that known by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where PBS recommendations are $100 and maybe PBS commercials are $200, both of which are a great way to support the ongoing production of The Greatest Generation.
Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible!
Drunk Shimoda!
Two, actually. They are the Nausicaans throwing darts at each other in the background of one of the Quark's bar scenes. Just like, we know so little about the Nausicaans except for the one TNG episode, the Nausicaan who stabbed Picard through the heart. One of the great TNG episodes. But like, you learn so much about them in what they do in their free time. It's Domchat and Games of Pain. And these two Nausicaans throwing darts at each other make them my Shimoda. What about you?
Before I get to my Shimoda for this episode, I have something fairly unprecedented, but I have to do it.
Wow, okay.
In watching this episode, we discover that packleds are scabs. They are willing to cross a picket line to fucking patronize a bar.
Pretty fucked up.
And my last, a packled was my Shimoda in the last episode.
Whoa, that's right.
I am going to strip that packled of drunk Shimoda status as a result of my disapproval of the packled scab ethos.
More like scab led.
Yeah. Fuck pack leds. Fuck crossing picket lines.
Wow.
I'm going to give my Shimoda in the last episode, and I apologize to Colin Dinsmore and the fine folks that run the Greatest Gen Wikia.
That's something they can just strike through, man.
Yeah.
That's within their power.
I'm gonna retroactively give my drunk Shimoda to Kern in the last episode for how silly he looked in that weird Cardassian biobed triangle thing.
Okay.
And then for this episode, gotta give it to Quark for the O face he makes when the strike starts.
Yeah, that's a crazy face. One of the great faces in the whole series, I think.
I laughed so hard when he did that.
Yeah, I rewound it a couple of times.
So
great
good.
Moment.
I wore out the head on the VHS tape, rewinding that little bit.
Gotta get that gold.
press that.
Moms can't live with them, can't find a great gift for them. It's madness, and it's the same every year. Mother's Day comes around, and it's like, what's it gonna be this year? Another robe, another candle, slippers, a sweater, flowers. We've got to do better than that, right? Well, you can, and it's actually the best gift you could possibly give a loved one, an Aura frame. Now, we have a policy to only do ads on our show for things that we actually like and use, and I gotta tell you, the Aura frame is probably the best gift I've ever given. The folks I've given an Aura frame to love it, and I love it too, because when you give an Aura frame, you're not just giving a person a bunch of old pictures, you're giving them new pictures every time you send one to it. Right now, Aura has a great sale for Mother's Day. Viewers can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com, and the code is SCARVES at checkout to show your support for the show. Terms and conditions apply.
Mother's Day is coming up, and one of the best gifts you can give a mom that you might share a bed with is doing some yard work. Some yard work downstairs, if you know what I mean. With Manscaped. This season, make sure you groom your carpets and your drapes with the leaders in below-the-waist grooming. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants to let the mother of your children know how much you appreciate her continuing to put up with you.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to... oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Well, Ben, what do we have coming up on the next episode?
The next episode is Season 4, Episode 16, Accession. A legendary Bajoran appears mysteriously after more than 200 years and challenges Sisko's claim to be the Emissary.
All right. I mean, it feels like Emissary status is a thing that Sisko would just assume grant to someone else. So maybe this isn't as much of a conflict as we think.
Yeah.
All right, Ben, let's see if we're going to watch this in any particular way by going to the Game of Buttholes Will of the Prophets game at gach.biz/game.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
Got the die in my hand, and just ahead, one square away, a Quark's Bar episode. A couple of squares beyond that would be a space butthole that would take us down to the second square where we would have landed on a His Eyes Uncovered. That is an episode where each of the hosts must employ 10 Temerian-style metaphors during the episode. So let's see what we get here, Ben. Oh, and I have landed on a 4. So we have hit the space butthole. We have slid down.
Wow.
One of the chutes down to square number 2.
God damn. Yeah. This is our first space butthole, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And so there it is. His Eyes Uncovered for the next episode. Both of us doing pre-writes.
Wow, fun.
For Temerian-style jokes. So yeah. That'll be great.
There are a lot of people in our audience that hate it when we write jokes for this show.
I know. Yeah. This is one for those people to skip.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, you and me both. Well, one thing we never skip is how much gratitude we have for our viewers.
The most amount of gratitude. The greatest gratitude, you might say. especially the folks that head to MaximumFun.org/donate, where you can set up a monthly contribution that supports the production of this program and pays us for our work. We really, really appreciate all of the fine folks that do that. It is a life changer for us.
Which camera is my camera? This camera?
Yeah, that's the one.
Viewer, I know you hear the difference. This show is better sounding than any other Star Trek show in existence.
Whoa, shots fired.
It sounds great. The production, look, I'm not saying that we're better than, I'm saying that no one else is better than, you know?
We try to do it at a level. We try to take the production super seriously.
And it's quality that you pay for. So thank you for supporting the show.
You can also support the show in a non-financial way, if that's where you are at in your finances, by recommending it to a friend, colleague, or loved one, or by using the recommendation or rating and review engine in your podcatcher of choice. That always is a big help. And also, tweet about what you like about the show on Twitter, or post on other social media, Facebook, whatever you like. Use the hashtag GreatestGen. Adam's on Twitter at CutForTime. I'm at Benjamin AHR. Also on Twitter, using that hashtag, you can find the great art of our buddy Bill Tilly, who makes trading cards of every episode. Always really, really funny to look at. He always picks amazing stills to illustrate his jokes. And also the art of J.J. Lendl, who makes a movie poster for every episode of Deep Space Nine and posts it the Sunday before we post our episode.
The great music on the show is made by Adam Ragusea, who has chopped and screwed the music of Dark Materia in many cases. You can find Adam Ragusea's YouTube page at YouTube, where he will teach you how to be a better cook. And I recommend you watch his videos and leave a nice comment there.
That would be great of you.
Is that it? That's it.
I think that's it, Adam.
And with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine, which may be having some complicated feelings, W/R/T, being the emissary.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.